The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the NC Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with what your pets want you to know. And there's a big picture of a cat with its usual kind of sly look. Yes, human, I am talking to you. And a dog looking at you that says, I don't even know what bad dog means. Science continuing to uncover your animal's most fascinating secrets. And then there's a picture of a pug. It says, I'm just a big baby. One, I'm basically a toddler. The secret to understanding dog behavior is that the average dog has a mind that's equivalent to that of a human 2 to 2.5 year old, Stanley Coren, Ph.D., a professor emeritus in the psychology department at the University of British Columbia, told Psychology Today. On average, dogs comprehend about 165 words, so they can follow a bit more than just walk and treat. They're also most likely to learn words associated with objects or activities, as opposed to words with emotions such as good doggy. Number two, but there are a few top dogs, super dogs, those in the top 20% of the intelligence spectrum, are a little closer to human 3-year-olds, and they can understand more than 250 words. Every now and then you get a Mozart or a Dickens of dogs who can understand 1,000 words, Coren says. Psychologist John Pilley's border collie, Chaser, shows knowledge of the names of 1,022 objects, according to a study Pilley published in Behavioral Processes in 2011. But John worked with her 4 hours a day like Mozart's dad, says Coren. Number three. I need to get out in the world. Young dogs that don't meet people or other dogs tend to grow up fearful and aggressive. Before they are 6 months old, puppies should meet 150 people and visit 50 different places. It doesn't have to be Zanzibar, Coren says. It could be rooms that are very different, machine shops, parking lots, whatever. Number four, I'll tell you when I'm lonely. Alert pet owners know that the pitch, duration, and frequency of their dog's bark differ depending on the circumstances, and researchers are learning what some of that nuance among vocalizations mean. For example, dogs bark differently when they're encountering a stranger than when they're hungry or want company. 2 to 4 high-pitched barks means the dog senses a threat and in alerting the pack to a potential danger, Gord says. But a long string of single barks that pauses in between, that probably means your dog is lonely. Number five, I also use my own sign language. Dogs do talk to you through barks and whines, but don't ignore their more physical communication, such as when Spot paws at the bottom of the sofa to indicate that his ball is hidden underneath. Dogs are excellent at adapting their body language to provide us clues about how they feel and what they want, says Monique A.R. Udell, Ph.D., an assistant professor in the Department of Animal and Rangeland Sciences at Oregon State University. Number six, you might be transferring your stress to me. Tension flows down the leash, Coren says. If you're tense and upset, your dog will start to act tense and upset, too. He recounts the story of a woman who didn't understand why her dog had started acting aggressive. When Coren found out she was troubled over a recent breakup with a boyfriend, he suggests that he focus on getting lots of exercise and socialization with her dog to help dissipate any tension she might be passing along to her pet. Number seven. Your nervousness might set me up for a fight, too. When an insecure dog owner approaches an unfamiliar dog, the owner might pull back on the leash, causing the dog's front legs to leave the ground. This stance is threatening to other dogs, which is why many react with hostility. Over time, an overly restrained dog will come to expect these reactions from the dog she meets, and she'll approach them with aggression herself. Number eight, I can be compulsive. Dogs chase their tails for lots of reasons. They're itchy or have bowel irritation. They are indulging their predatory nature, or they're just bored, according to Canine Journal. In certain cases, though, tail chasing could be a sign of canine compulsive disorder. The condition can develop when a dog is frequently stressed or frustrated. Veterinarian Stephanie Lift told PetMD.com, once the stressor is removed, the dog will likely stop his odd behavior. Number nine, I don't feel guilty, ever. Like their intelligence, dogs' emotional maturity is similar to that of toddlers. The average 2 to 3 year old has all the basic emotions like joy and sadness and fear and anger and disgust and surprise, Coren says. But they don't have complex social emotions like guilt, shame, and pride. When you come home to find that your dog has made a mess and she tucks her tail and looks ashamed, She's really just afraid of your anger. She's smart enough to associate the mess with your being upset, but guilt isn't part of her repertoire. Number 10. But I do get jealous. Did your dog snap at you when you petted another pooch at the park? He could be jealous. Researchers compared how dogs reacted when their owners were paying attention to either to a stuffed dog or to another inanimate object, such as a pail or a book. Nearly three-quarters of the dog exhibited jealous behavior about the fake canine, but only 42% and 23% reacted badly to the pail and book, respectively. Scientists suspect that the canine jealousy dates back to the days when dogs competed for food and other resources. Number 11. I may have a mood disorder. And there's a picture of a cute little, looks like a little tiny terrier. 8% of dog owners and 6% of cat owners have given their pets medicine for anxiety and other mood disorders, according to a study on the market research firm Package Facts. The FDA has approved pet variations of human medicines for separation anxiety, noise aversion, and cognitive dysfunction, the Washington Post reports. Number 12. My hearing may be worse if you have light-colored fur. Dogs that have predominantly white coats have a higher chance of being born deaf or at least one ear. In fact, 30% of Dalmatians are born with this condition, according to Corin. The gene that causes a dog to have white coat just happens to be associated with deafness, as well as with blue eyes. I dream bigger if I'm a large dog. Little dogs have shorter, more frequent dreams than big dogs. You can see it happen if you watch dogs sleeping. When they start to dream, their breathing becomes irregular, and you can see their eyes moving back and forth under their closed lids, Corin says. A pug might have 5 or 6 one-minute dreams every 90 minutes, but a St. Bernard is more likely to have a 4-minute dream every 45 minutes. Researchers know because they can scan dogs' brains just as they can ours. Number 14. I can detect cancer. Several studies have shown that dogs can detect whether a person has certain types of cancer, including breast, colorectal, lung, ovarian, prostate, and skin cancer. How? By sniffing a person's breath, urine, or blood. Given a dog's acute sense of smell, scientists think canines can pick up on volatile organic compounds that cancer cells give off. Unfortunately, dogs have not proved to be reliable diagnosticians. They get bored and lose interest in sniffing samples after a short while. Cats. Number 15. I'm not sure whether you're a cat or a human. While dogs play with humans differently than they do with fellow canines, cats don't adjust their social behavior much for us. Putting their tails up in the air, rubbing around our legs, and sitting beside us and grooming us are exactly what cats do to each other, John Bradshaw, a University of Bristol anthrozoologist. And the author of Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet, told National Geographic. And there's a picture of a bright yellow cat with looks like a Superman cape flying out behind it. Number 16. I like spending time with you. They don't always show it, but cats like us. They really, really like us. Cats can be incredibly social, Udall says. In fact, in recent tests of cat preferences, the majority of pet and shelter cats preferred human interaction over toys, food, and even catnip. Number 17. And I do not like being ignored. Cats will more frequently approach and play with a person who is attentive to them compared to a person who is ignoring them, says Kristen Vitale, Ph.D., a researcher in the Human-Animal Interaction Lab at Oregon State University. Then again, she says, sometimes cats want to be left alone. Vitale says if a cat is showing signs of aggression, dilated pupils, a fast twitching tail, fur standing on end, hissing or growling, just walk away. It's better to end the interaction before an incident occurs that may lead to a strain on the relationship, she says. Number 18. Yes, I'm talking to you. Bradshaw says feral cats he studied rarely meow. Domesticated cats, on the other hand, meow all the time to get the attention of humans. Number 19. Purring doesn't always mean I'm happy. Cats often purr if they're sick or injured. They're essentially saying they need your help and want you to stay nearby for comfort. Another theory is that the action of purring is physically healing for cats. Gary Weitzman, a veterinarian and CEO of the San Diego Humane Society, told the BBC that the frequency of a cat's purr is similar to the frequencies of vibrations associated with bone and tissue healing. Number 20. My purring might help you, too. The frequencies of a cat purr may confer health benefits to nearby humans. It calms us and pleases us, like watching waves against the beach, Dr. Weizman told the BBC. Response to a cat's purr as a common stimulus, and may even genetically select cats with more propensity to purr. Number 21. I care what you think. For a study in animal cognition in 2015, researchers set up an unfamiliar and slightly scary scenario, if you're a cat. An electric fan with ribbons attached. When cats entered the room with their owner, 75% looked back and forth between their person and the fan, indicated they were trying to see whether the human was afraid. Half the owners were told to act confident and approach the fan. The other half were told nervous and move away from it. The cats whose people seemed scared were significantly more likely to direct their gaze to the room's exit. 22. But I still might treat you as if you're not there. Japanese researchers found in a recent study that cats recognized their own names. Regardless of who was speaking, most cats reacted in the same way, moving their heads or perking up their ears when their names were spoken, the researchers wrote. So if Fluffy isn't coming when you call, yep, she's probably just ignoring you. 23. I hold a grudge. Your feline friend not only remembers the sound of the can opener and the jingle of his favorite toy, he also remembers who sprayed him with water pistol to get him off the dinner table. Cats don't forgive, and once they realize a person is causing them anxiety or hurt, they keep away, Bradshaw says. 24. I'm not trying to make you mad. Cats are stretching, flexing, removing dead cells from their claws, and marking territory when they scratch furniture, according to the Humane Society. There's also a reason behind their spraying. Unlike us, they find the scent comforting, and they spray to feel more secure in a stressful situation. Cats are control freak, Kathy Lund, a feline-only veterinarian in Providence, Rhode Island, told PetMMD.com. They like to feel in charge. That's pretty obvious. 25. I learn for life. Once cats master an essential skill such as hunting, they remember it, according to Animal Planet. Even after they've spent years indoors eating commercial food, cats who learn to kill as kittens can still hunt down their own dinner if the need arises. 26. Your nurturing affects my nature. Just as kids can be influenced by the environment in which they grow up, an owner's personality can rub off on a cat. One study found that cats with neurotic owners were more prone to exhibit stress, fear, and even aggression. 27. In fact, you often train me, whether you know it or not. Many people think of cats as independent-minded, but you do reinforce their behavior, says Sarah Ellis, co-author of The Trainable Cat. For instance, your cat is smart enough to know that you don't want her walking on the kitchen counter, but she likes the attention she gets when you run and snatch her off at every time. Ellis says you can use treats to teach Kitty to come when called, giving you a positive means to lure her away from difficult situations. 28. Confined spaces make her feel safe. That's why cats climb right into those shoeboxes and suitcases. Dutch researchers who studied 19 newly arrived shelter cats found that the ones who were allowed to hide in boxes exhibited significantly less stress than the cats who didn't have a hidey hole. 29. I'm not as good a poker player as you may think. Cats do express their emotions on their faces, according to a 2017 study in behavioral processes. Researchers made short video clips at a Canadian shelter to track and code cats' facial expressions. They determined that blinking and half-blinking are associated with fear. Cats also show frustration by hissing, raising their upper lips, licking and wrinkling their noses, and showing their tongues. And when they're relaxed, they often gaze to the right. 30. I don't like to share. Sharing food or water bowls or a litter box can make cats anxious, according to veterinarian Katrina Warren. If you have multiple cats, maintain separate dishes and litter boxes for each one. Does your cat still seem anxious? Provide your kitty with a place to perch, since cats appreciate high places and autonomy. Number 31. I can live with a dog sometimes. Research has shown that you'll be more successful introducing a dog to a home where a cat already lives, as opposed to vice versa, according to Dr. Warren. But do it gradually. Let them become aware of each other first through a closed door, so they get used to each other's scent. Then provide your cat a safe haven, a place the dog can't enter. Number 32. I dream when I'm deep in slumber. About a quarter of most cats, Catster says, has been in deep sleep when they're curled up with their eyes closed all the way. A landmark study in 1950 suggested that cats may dream about stalking prey and getting into fights. Number 33. My meows change as I age. Cats may become increasingly vocal as they get older. Why? Age-related dementia and failing eyesight are two potential explanations, John Wright, Ph.D., a certified animal behaviorist at Mercer University, told HumaneSociety.org. An anxious cat may vocalize more, and a feline who is losing his hearing may also meow louder. Fish. I can really be a clownfish. Two pictures of two fish. 34. I can recognize humans. Archerfish hunt by shooting a stream of water at insects. Researchers have taken advantage of this special kill to test their ability to recognize human faces. The fish were taught that when they shot water at an image of a specific face on a computer screen, they would receive a snack. When scientists later showed the fish a variety of faces on the screen, they shot only at the water only at the one that they previously resulted in food. 35. I really can be a clownfish. Psychologist Richard Wiseman, Ph.D., that reports that more than half of the fish owners in an online survey for his website, Quirkology, said their fish had a good sense of humor. In fact, the survey revealed that that fish appreciate humor more than cats, horses, and birds, but not as much as dogs do. Wonder what they mean by humor. Parrots, 36. I mimic humans well because I'm good at copying other parrots. In the wild, parrots live in large cohesive groups and squawk constantly, updating one another on where the best sources of seeds are and which direction to search next for food. Timothy F. Wright, co-author of Parrots of the Wild, A Natural History of the World's Most Captivating Birds, told the New York Times that it's rare for wild parrots to mimic sounds made by other species. But in captivity, they'll mimic bopping dogs, car alarms, and human speech in an attempt to bond with their human flocks. Number 7. 37. Horses. I can gauge your mood. A study in biology letters showed that horses can tell the difference between happy and angry human expressions. When they look at the photographs of people making negative faces, their heart rates climbed and they turned their heads to allow themselves to focus with their left eye. Researchers think this left-eye gaze happens because the right hemisphere of the brain is better at processing negative emotions. Horses are not alone in this skill. A 2016 study found that dogs could tell from photos of human faces, expressions, and recordings of viruses whether the person in question was happy or sad or mad. They can read the faces and vocalization of other dogs, too. 38. And I remember you were mad the last time I saw you. In another study, several hours after horses were shown photographs of people with happy or angry expressions, those same people visited the horses in person, wearing neutral faces. If a horse had previously seen an angry-looking photo of that person, it exhibited a left gaze bias and showed other signs of stress, including scratching the floor. But horses visited by people who were happy in the photographs weren't stressed at all. Number 39 is hamsters. I can learn to take risks. A 2015 experiment found that hamsters whose cages had received only fancy upgrades, extra bedding, chew toys, a tent, were more inclined to take a risk, drinking from a new water dispenser when they didn't know whether it contained sweet or bitter liquid. Hamsters whose upgrades were replaced with cardboard tubes and squeaky wheels, on the other hand, were less likely to go for it, seemingly figured that they couldn't expect nicer things in life. Beware of Richie Rich. If you want to know what it's like to owe a loan shark, borrow $5 from a 10-year-old. Losing Laura. National Interest. My wife is having an asthma attack, so she took herself to the emergency room. Why is she left outside to die just outside the hospital doors? In November 2017, we published an article, Thank You for Caring So Much, a man's letter of appreciation to the hospital workers who tried to save his wife from a decimating asthma attack. But it turns out there was much more to the story than we knew at the time. Laura Levis, the love of my life, died on September 22, 2016. She was just 34. I was told that Laura never made it to the emergency room, that she collapsed on the street leading to CHA Somerville Hospital in Somerville, Massachusetts, or possibly in a parking lot on the outskirts of the property. My wife had called 911 just after 4 a.m. before she lost consciousness. She wasn't able to give her exact location, they told me, so it took emergency responders a long time to find her. She was in the last place he looked, someone said, even though that place was heartbreakingly close. Some 10 minutes passed between the time Laura called 911 and the time she was found. In cardiac arrest following an asthma attack, those 10 minutes meant her life. People, of course, die from asthma, a disease that affects 19 million adults and 6 million children in the United States. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than 3,500 succumb to attacks each year, though in Laura's age group, the death rate is less than 1 in 10,000 asthmatics. It's especially rare in those as healthy and active as she was. Laura worked out 6 days a week and composed powerful lifting and competed in powerlifting competitions where she could bench press more than she weighed. Her asthma never impeded her. Laura was vigilant about carrying inhalers, boxing up her clothes. I found 20 of them in her pockets, purses, and gym bags. On rare occasions when an attack intensified, I would drive Laura to Mount Auburn Hospital in Cambridge, where she'd be given prednisone, a nebulizer treatment, or both. We always arrived in plenty of time. But I wasn't with my wife that September day, and the reason for that I'll have to live with forever. At the time Laura collapsed, we were spending some time apart. We were seeing a couple's counselor and had been in daily contact with each other. We had dinner plans the day she collapsed and were going apple picking that weekend, but we had slept apart the night before. She stayed, as fate would have it, in an apartment just a few blocks from Somerville Hospital. I blame myself for not being with her when the attack struck, for not being able to help my wife in that moment. I ask God why. Why? One day I would receive an answer. Somerville Hospital sits on a hill, with its emergency room at the very top. Dressed in purple sneakers, jeans, and her favorite hoodie from a Spartan race we ran together, Laura began walking up the hill that morning in the midst of her attack. It's about a 375-foot walk up Tower Street. Surveillance camera first caught sight of her at 4:21 a.m. When Laura arrived at the hospital, she found a similar circular driveway and two entrances about 100 feet apart. Between them, there were four waiting benches, each with a flat stone top. Signs pointing to the emergency room had led her up the hill, but inexplicably, neither entrance was adorned with an illuminated emergency room sign. With no clear indications where to go, Laura had to choose one door or the other. On the surveillance video, she pauses, then chooses the entrance on the right. As she approached it, she could see an emergency room waiting area through the plate glass windows. She stepped in front of the automatic door, but it did not open. Surprised, she put both hands on the door and peered inside, but there was no one in sight. Panic can accelerate an asthma attack by causing airway muscles to tighten, constricting airflow even further. Finding the door locked, Laura almost certainly panicked. Maybe that is why she didn't comprehend the instruction posted on the door, explaining it was for ambulance access only. To enter the emergency room, Peaches needed to use the main entrance, the door to the left, the door she had not chosen. Or perhaps she did notice the instructions on the instructions. In a video, Laura turns and begins walking toward the main entrance. She didn't make it there. She walked past the first two waiting benches, but when Laura reached the third bench, just 29 feet from the main entrance, she sat down. The attack had become so intense she could not walk those extra 29 feet. But she could still think clearly. She called 911. Her voice on the phone with the dispatchers is filled with fear. "I'm at Somerville Hospital," were Laura's first word. "I'm having an asthma attack. I'm dying." "Where are you at the hospital?" asked 911 operator. "Emergency room," Laura responded. "I can't get in." In just 41 seconds, she managed to relate seemingly everything the operator needed to know. Laura said she was having an asthma attack, one so severe that she felt she was going to die. She said she was at Somerville Hospital outside the emergency room and couldn't get in. Laura was an amazing communicator, a journalist, and with her life on the line, she didn't waste a single word. If only she had been talking to the right persons. Laura's cell phone was routed to a regional 911 operator. The operator, sitting in a Massachusetts State Police operation, some 18 miles away, was merely a call screener who couldn't send help. When Laura finished speaking, the operator told her to stay on the line as she connected Laura to the local police. When the police picked up, a new operator asked her to explain all over again what her emergency was. By then, she could barely speak. "She's outside the Somerville Hospital," the regional operator said, jumping in. "She's having an asthma attack. She can't get into the hospital." It shouldn't have been so easy for the two operators to locate Laura, since both had her cell number. A satellite ping of her GPS coordinates provided by her carry would make Laura a digital dot on their computer screen. Street maps. But as could be the case with cell phone 911 calls, her locations on their screen was wrong. When you use an app involving your location, your phone constantly transmits where you are, like a homing beacon. But when you make a 911 call, that doesn't happen. Instead, a satellite must be pinged, and that information is integrated with other bits of data to trace where you're calling from, a more complex and often inexact process. Laura's ping registered as 68 Tower Street, a street corner some 200 feet from the hospital's front door. Somerville's police dispatcher asked Laura exactly where she was. "Ma'am, where are you located?" "You're the one, you're at 208 Highland Avenue, right?" That's the hospital's official mailing address on a completely different side of the building, but it was the only address the dispatcher had. It would have been the perfect moment for the original 911 operator to array more information, such as the fact that Laura twice said she was outside the emergency room, that she twice said she was dying. But that operator had already hung up. In the line 11 tape, you can hear Laura's voice again. "I'm outside," she started to say before struggling to make another sound. "It's 4:25 a.m. and 36 seconds. It was the last time Laura speaks. It was the moment her life hinged upon. With a minute or so, her heart would stop beating, and oxygen would stop going to her brain. On the surveillance video, about 30 seconds later, Laura slumps on the stone bench, her arms falling to her side. A glowing object, her cell phone, falls to the ground. And then, stillness. It's unclear how long it takes for your brain to die without oxygen, although there are some estimates based on medical research. After 3 minutes or less, you might fully recover. Between 3 and 6 minutes, your chances drop, but still recovery can be possible. Beyond 6 minutes, there's little chance your brain won't be severely damaged, but a death is much more likely to occur. Wow. This is a little personal information. I don't normally give it out. I recently had some surgery, and during the surgery, so what was supposed to be minor surgery, and during the surgery, my heart stopped. Apparently, they got it started within that 3-minute window because I suffered no ill effects other than some very cracked ribs and being stuck in the hospital for a while. Thank the Lord I was able to survive. Laura's countdown probably began a few seconds after 4:26 a.m., although it's possible for her heart kept beating for another minute after she lost consciousness. According to asthma experts, every second was vital, yet so many would be wasted. After realizing Laura couldn't speak anymore, the Somerville police dispatcher told her to hold on while she called an ambulance. That took more than a minute that Laura would never get back. The police next called the Somerville Fire Department, which has a station just 1,000 feet from the hospital. But the police dispatchers merely relayed Laura must be on Tower Side, failing to settle their cell phone plinged at 68 Tower Street at the top of the hill, or that she was outside the emergency room. Without those details, the fire department dispatcher had to guess where Laura was. Following a hunch, he sent a crew to the other side of the hospital where the entrance to some doctor's office is locked overnight. Attention Agent 7 responds to the Somerville Hospital, 230 Highland Avenue. We believe this is possibly on a medical arts building side. Somerville Hospital is last to be reached by phone. There's no direct line to the emergency room, apparently, even for police, so a night receptionist had to patch the call through. The transfer took about 30 seconds. More time wasted. Finally, 2 minutes after Laura had lost consciousness, a phone in the emergency room rang. A nurse, whom I called Nurse X, answered. "Hi, it's Somerville Police. Are your doors locked by any chance, dispatcher?" "No. Why?" responded Nurse X. "Because there's a female who's having an asthma attack. She's pinging off Tower Street, and she's saying the emergency room is closed. So I don't know where she is," the dispatcher continued. "I'll go look," said Nurse X. Hang up, she walks to the ambulance access door, which he found locked, and opened it. On the surveillance video, you see Nurse X take one step outside, craning her neck as she peers into the pre-dawn darkness. Laura's just about 70 feet from her, but the bench where Laura collapsed is not well lighted, so Nurse X does not spot her. She's hovered at the door for 12 seconds, going no farther before returning inside. It would have been easy for the hospital security to have seen Laura on camera, but the desk had been left unattended as both officers were on duty were needed for a patient, watches inside the emergency room. Nurse X sees those officers when she returns, but not tell them about Laura. Instead, she calls the Somerville Police back. "I looked outside up here, but I didn't see anything," she told the dispatcher. She offered to call Laura's cell phone. Seconds later on the surveillance video, you see Laura's phone light up on the ground. but she cannot answer it, and it goes dark. Failing to find Laura at the doctor's office door, the Engine 7 crew headed up the hill on foot. Firefighter Derfarino was the first to spot Laura, rushing to her and ripping her hoodie in two to start CPR, but he was too late. Farino had taken only 3 minutes to walk up Tower Street, but those 3 minutes pushed the time Laura had gone without oxygen to her brain to upward of 7 minutes. And while a heart can be restarted at that point, as hers was, people rarely survive. Laura was at last brought inside the emergency room some 15 minutes after she called 911. It wasn't until hours later at 7:15 that someone from the hospital called me and told me that Laura had collapsed. When I got there, no one could tell me a whole lot more. The night shift that had started Laura's heart and put her on life support was no longer on duty. We spent 7 days in the ICU at CHA Cambridge Hospital, Somerville's sister hospital. During all that time, I barely left my wife's bedside. No one mentioned anything to me about Laura making to the doorstep of Somerville's emergency room. Even a month later, after the New York Times published my thank you letter, no one had said a word to me about Laura being outside that door, and maybe they never would have. But the circumstances surrounding Laura's death deeply bothered her uncle, Robert Levis. Uncle Bob called the Somerville police, asked whether there was a police report that could explain what happened. I was told there would be no report, as officers didn't write up medical calls. But Detective Michael Perrone and his fellow officers were so deeply moved by Laura's death that they broke protocol. They interviewed the firefighters who had found Laura and one of the guards on duty that night and viewed surveillance footage from the hospital's cameras, describing all they observed in writing in case that footage was ever erased. Uncle Bob showed the report with Laura's dad, Dr. William Levis, a former officer of the U.S. Public Health Service. I will never forget my father-in-law's voice cracking apart when he called me. "Pete, I have the most terrible thing to tell you," he said. "They killed Laura." Throughout the numerous letters and phone calls, I obtained the grainy, horrible surveillance video showing Laura outside the hospital. I obtained from the state police the shattering recording of Laura's 911 call. I sought out every document I could find. Police and fire reports, ambulance reports, state investigators' reports, field notes from the hospital inspections, and internal hospital documents, which I requested through the Freedom of Information Act. And I spoke with lawyers at the largest medical malpractice firm in Boston. Suing Somerville Hospital would not give Laura the chance to live her life, to be a mother, to grow old with me. Still, if its owners, Cambridge Health Alliance, was made to pay millions in damages, it would potentially send a message to hospitals across the country to reevaluate their emergency room procedures. By making the hospital pay, I thought, maybe Laura's death would stand for something. The Massachusetts Department of Public Health turned up more patient safety violations at Somerville Hospital, citing it for failing to provide a safe environment and for poor quality of pre-hospital care. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services accused Somerville Hospital of violating federal law by denying Laura access to the emergency care. Officials agreed to pay $90,000 to the government in a settlement. But my hope of making the hospital pay went no further than that. In Massachusetts, a law protects public hospitals from being sued for more than $100,000 and indemnifies their employees even in cases of wrongful death. Without the CAF, we'd like to be looking at a multi-million dollar verdict, assuming we won. With the cap, Laura's death, in the eyes of the law, hardly seemed to matter. But how could her death not matter? How could I go on living if Laura's tragedy changed nothing? And so I began writing her story. The Federal Communications Commission estimates that 10,000 lives could be saved annually if emergency responders could get to 9/11 callers just 1 minute faster, and that figure could be vastly conservative. What can be done to save those lives, to make sure that no one else dies the way Laura did? Here are a number of possible solutions. For one, I hope that regional 911 call centers become a thing of the past. Had Laura's call gone directly to the Somerville Police Department, I'm convinced that a local dispatcher, familiar with the hospital, would have asked Laura whether she was at the top or the bottom of the hill. It isn't just my view. 911 calls misrouted to wrong call centers are a national issue. Millions of 9/11 calls register inaccurate locations each year because of tree interference, poor atmospheric conditions, and other challenges, per the National Emergency Numbers Association. Locations are often so often wrong that, according to one survey, 82% of 9/11 operators doubt the location information they receive. Incredibly, Laura's location would have been considered accurate, according to FCC standards, even though it first led responders astray. A push is underway for states to adopt the next-generation 9/11 system, in which callers will be able to send text messages, photos, and videos to help emergency responders locate them and assess their crisis. With such a system, Laura conceivably could have sent a photo to the ambulance access door to her 9/11 operator, who in turn could have texted it to Engine 7's crews or even to Nurse X. Thanks to the software upgrades, Android and Apple phones can now automatically relay 9/11 callers' coordinates to the operator. The location readings can still be off by hundreds of feet, but they are more frequently leading responders to almost the exact location. Far more needs to be done by mobile service providers and regulators to improve the system, but at least some progress is being made. Medical errors have become the country's third leading cause of death, resulting in as many as 250,000 deaths per year, according to a study by Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Another study estimates the number could be as high as 440,000. In Laura's case, something as simple as requiring two people to conduct a search, a second set of eyes, could have made the difference, and the nurses can reduce commonplace errors simply by reminding themselves never to skip a single step in whatever they're doing, such as walking 100 feet between the two doors, just to make sure no one is there. The same goes for those with medical conditions, particularly serious ones as asthma. Laura did not miscalculate that morning, but she should have been more careful. She should have told someone she was having an attack and should never have walked alone to the hospital. It is a message I pray everyone who reads this will pass along to the people in their lives who have asthma, a message that Sumata Khatri, MD, an asthma expert and coordinator at the Cleveland Clinic Asthma Center, stressed to me when explaining just how quickly asthma can turn fatal. If an attack strikes when you're alone, let someone know, because even if you reach the door of a hospital, you might not get in. After the full version of this story appeared on bostonglobe.com, hospital leaders apologized and acknowledged that mistakes had cost Laura life. Today, when you approach the front of Sunrail Hospital, the entrance that Laura found locked is the main public doorway to the emergency room. There's a large aluminum emergency sign above it, as well as several additional signs on the property, pointing patients to that entrance, which is never locked. The bench where Laura collapsed is now bathed in bright light at night, and security cameras are always monitored. Peter DeMarco continues to advocate for things change pending 9/11 administrators to rechain operators and filling legislatures, Laura's law to recreate standards for hospitals requiring signage, lighting, and monitoring of doors. Though the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America, he has sought to bring attention to Asthma Peak Week, when common triggers are at the highest levels. It strikes the third week in September, the week Laura had her attack, and he established the Lift for Laura Foundation to fund personal gym training sessions for underprivileged and abused women in his wife's memory. Over the Limit, the world's feast-pitting ticket was written in 1896 in the village of Paddockwick, England. The violator was caught driving 8 miles per hour through a 2-mile-per-hour zone and fined 10 shillings. Now let's roll over to Consumer Reports. Road Report, why it pays to wait. Snapping up a brand new model in year one is exciting, but can often result in more headaches than happiness. Our exclusive survey of CR members can steer you to the choice you won't regret. For car lovers, a dealership showroom can evoke that proverbial kid in a candy store feeling as you ogle the high-sheen brand new models dripping with cutting-edge technology. Not to be a buzzkill, but we're here to advise you to resist. Instead, consider a model that's several years into its redesign life. Why? CR proprietary analysis shows what vehicles tend to be most reliable by the final year of any particular model run, typically 5 to 7 years. After many of the bugs have been worked out, the least reliable in the first year of redesign, when freshly reconvened and often touted as all new. It's tempting to want to be the first on your block to have the newest car, but that comes with reliability risks, says Jade Fisher, CR's Senior Director of Auto Testing. Being patient can save you from years of frustration. When a model is redesigned, the name, such as Chevrolet Malibu or Toyota Camry, usually stays the same, but the body, transmission, engine, and other parts might get updates. It may be safer to have desirable features, but with those changes come hiccups or malfunctions, which automakers track through customer complaints and address through updates, recalls, or revisions to how they build their model. In this way, the vehicle matures into improved reliability making it a choice that consumers can have more confidence about buying. In general, we found that it can make automakers 2 to 3 years or even longer to address problems in newly resigned models. For example, in 2017, CR members reported the Honda Odyssey as reliable, but they reported multiple problems after its 2018 redesign, mainly with the infotainment system and power equipment, causing the minivan to lose its recommendation. The problems have persisted with the 2019 model, unfortunately. Some automakers can resolve the headaches quickly. The 2018 Tesla Model 3 has suffered from problems including cracks in the rear window glass, loose trim, and paint defects. Members reported far fewer of those concerned with the 2019 Model 3. Our latest survey shows that fewer members reported, regaining a CR recommendation. Still, there are brands such as Toyota and Lexus that often had fewer glitches with their redesigns. The redesigned 2019 Toyota Avalon and Lexus ES both had well above average first-year reliability. Despite terminology used in ads from manufacturers, any given car, minivan, SUV, or truck isn't all new every year. In fact, sometimes it isn't any different from the year before. However, during a model's 5 to 7 year life, before it's updated entirely, there may be changes. The terms below explain the different types of changes. Freshening. This refers to minor updates that can occur in the middle of an existing model's production run, often done to drive up consumer interest. Sometimes this means styling tweaks such as a new grille or headlight design, or a new paint color and interior color combinations. In other cases, the model might get an updated engine or transmission, or an updated infotainment system. These keep the model competitive, but avoid the huge cost of a full-on redesign. For example, the Audi Q7's freshening for the 2020 model year incorporates a new infotainment system, engine, and styling details. Redesign. These are updated versions of a model that has been sold for at least one generation. For example, the Mercedes-Benz GLE and the Ford Explorer are existing models that were completely redesigned for 2020. This will often have new engines, transmissions, suspensions, advanced safety systems, and interior design. Some redesigns will incrementally grow or shrink the size of the car. The more extensive or complicated the redesign, the higher the risk of reliability problems. Some redesigns are the basis for future models. For example, the redesign of the 2017 Subaru Impreza had extensive problems with in-car electronics, such as the backup camera. Subaru addressed the concerns and incorporated the fixes into the redesigned 2018 Crosstrek SUV, which uses most of the same parts as the Impreza. That model didn't have those problems. All new. When properly used, this term denotes a debut model, never built before or one reintroduced after having taken off the market for years, such as the Toyota Supra. Other recent examples of all-new models include the Audi e-tron, Kia Telluride, and Cadillac XT6. Some all-new models might share some major components with an existing model, such as the Cadillac XT6 and GMC Acadia SUVs. This can have fewer problems because some bugs have already been identified and sorted out. CR buys and tests nearly every new and resigned model. We may test a freshened model if there are significant changes, such as a new engine and transmission. And then there's a graph here that's kind of interesting because this happens to be a car that I used to own. This data shows the BMW X3's reliability right after redesign. The SUV was redesigned in 2011, and it took till the 2016 model to work out the bugs. It was redesigned again for 2018. The X3 suffered first-year flaws, and that model year continues to have well below average reliability. The data shows that the automaker was quickly addressed the flaws of the first-year model so that it didn't plague the 2019 X3, which has above average reliability. Well, I bought mine, or I leased mine, in 2016 and 2017, and I had almost no problems with it. However, in 2018, I started to have some problems, so I traded in and got a different model. The 2019 model, however, is showing improved reliability, and that's because they picked up on those things. And with that, we've finished that month's consumer reports. So let's go to the next month. The gender safety gap. I've driven thousands of miles over my lifetime. This is from the president and CEO. I've driven thousands of miles over my lifetime. My first car was a hand-me-down that took me back and forth between home and college, then down to Washington, D.C. for my first job. Then there was my first cross-country adventure, to see the sights and visit France. Over the years and across the miles, I put my trust in the car I drove. Like most Americans, I assumed that automakers were designing and testing cars with my safety in mind. But then I learned that my three brothers can drive on the road with more confidence than I or any other woman can. That's because, shockingly, there are no truly accurate adult female crash test dummies. When frontal crash tests are performed to determine safety ratings, dummies modeled on the average male are used as a stand-in for all adults, with the closest representation of a female form is just the male dummy scaled down enough that it can double as a 12-year-old child. If that doesn't alarm you, consider this. Research shows that the odds for women being seriously injured in a frontal crash are 73% greater than they are for men, even when both are wearing seat belts. Despite the strides we made in car safety technology, a crash testing system that fails to account for women's physiology has ignored half of our population, exposing us to greater danger. That's why CR safety experts at our test track are shining light on this issue. Read more about their findings on page 52, which we will. Earlier this fall, two members of Congress pushed the government agency that oversees vehicle safety to conduct more research on crash test bias to ensure women's safety. While this process could take decades to implement, the stakes of doing nothing are simply too high. With today's technology, failing to confront such inequality is simply inexcusable. At CR, we will continue to bring this problem out of our country's blind spot and spark automakers to create safety, safer, fairer systems for everyone. Building a better world together. Safer sleep for infants. What's at stake? In April 2019, Consumer Reports released a finding of an investigation into the Fisher-Price Rock and Play sleeper, published in the July 2019 issue of Consumer Reports. The product was designed without independent safety testing to soothe infants with acid reflux by enabling them to sleep at an incline. But we highlighted that doing so contradicts medical advice, and we found that the product had been tied to dozens of infants' deaths. A government-funded study has since shown that inclined sleepers increase the risk of infant suffocation. The CR reported prompted the recall of all 4.7 million Rock and Pay sleepers, and other manufacturers pulled their inclined sleepers from the retail shelves as well. Then, in October, the Consumer Product Safety Commission began advising caregivers not to use any infant inclined sleepers and voted to begin the process of banning them altogether. How CR has your back? Despite all this, CR and other organizations have found out that many inclined sleepers remain for sale and in use, and it may take months or longer for a government ban to kick in. That's why CR continues working to rid the market of these inherently unsafe products. In November, CR President Marta Tellado wrote to 9 juvenile product manufacturers urging them to recall all infant inclined sleepers immediately. We also asked consumers to email companies with the same requests. By Thanksgiving, more than 13,500 had sent some 125,000 messages. Finally, we wrote 13 retailers on online platforms urging them to remove the products from shelves and marketplace. As of December 5th, Amazon, Bye Bye Baby, eBay, and Walmart agreed. Protecting personal data. What's at stake? The massive 2017 Equifax data breach prompted Congress to pass a law letting a consumer place a free security freeze on their credit reports. That was important because without a freeze, credit bureaus will sell your data to any lender that asks. With a freeze in place, they can't do so without getting your explicit consent, making it harder for identity thieves to open an account in your name. Security freezes are optional, however, and consumers must actively set up a freeze at each of the three major bureaus. How CR has your back. CR believes the system is backward. Consumers should have to opt in before their credit reports are shared, not opt out to keep them private. That's why supporting a new bill, the Consumer Credit Control Act, which would make security freezes the default for all credit reports. If passed, credit bureaus would have to get your affirmative consent and verify your identity before giving creditors access to files. When applying for a loan or credit account, you'll be able to lift the freeze temporarily, generally by creating an online account at the credit bureau website. Backing better lending laws. What's at stake? For decades, CR has warned about the so-called predatory lenders, purporting to offer a lifeline to people desperate to pay bills or cover unexpenses. These companies often use deceptive tactics to trap borrowers into an endless cycle of high interest debt and huge fees. As a result, many as a third of customers end up deeper in debt when they started. How CR has your back. California has long set a legal limit on the interest rates for certain loans below $2,500. But rates on larger loans have gone unchecked. Some lenders in the state charge more than 200% a year. But that loophole will soon close. In October, Governor Gavin Newsom signed a law that CR supports, the Fair Access to Credit Act. The law caps rates on loans over $2,500 at 36%, plus the federal funds rate, which is currently about 2%, and bans several practices, including prepayment penalties, known to ensnare borrowers in revolving debt. The new law is a crucial test, first step towards reining in abusive lenders and promoting fairer financial services, to CR senior policy counsel Suzanne Martindale, who was on hand when the bill was signed. And now let's do some feedback. Our column in December 2019 issue, Building a Better World Together, discusses how some states are offering more electric vehicle choices to consumers. How exactly does Colorado plan to require an automaker to sell a certain type of car? If I walk into a Colorado car dealership, will someone inform me that I must buy a certain kind of car because the manufacturer is required to sell them? Surely this is an absurd way to promote EVs. Tom Wyatt, Austin, Texas. You won't be forced to purchase a specific kind of vehicle when you walk into a dealership. The requirement in Colorado, initially around 5%, simply increases the EV offers at your dealership and is expected to be small enough to increase to be easily achievable because many prospective car buyers in Colorado are interested in buying them. And many electric vehicles, depending on how much they are driven, may be able to deliver a lower overall cost of ownership because the driver saves on not only fuel costs, but also short-term maintenance costs. To learn about newly proposed fees on EV cars, in some states, look farther back, and we'll look at that. I was surprised at the comparisons between Nissan Leaf Plus and the Honda and Kia EVs. The Leaf is hardly outclassed by them. I found my Leaf to be fun to drive, fast, silent, powerful, and very comfortable at highway speeds. Not every driver needs a car that can be driven 600 miles between fueling stops. W. Jeffrey Sindley in Washington. Please do not call EVs zero-emission cars. They use electricity that, at this time, is mostly produced from fossil fuel that is being said. I love my Honda Clarity plug-in hybrid, J. Michael Rockwell. The zero and zero emission refers specifically to the vehicle's tailpipe emissions, and that there are none. Though some emissions might be created in the energy-producing process, that's not always the case because some homes are solar-powered. It's also an important distinction because not all emissions are created equal. Tailpipe emissions create localized smog and leave behind a lot of harmful chemicals. In Shop Smarter for Supplements, December 2019, you state that even though increased efforts by the Food and Drug Administration to enforce the law are a positive step, consumers have a right to expect the FDA to have been doing this all along. The FDA tried to establish tougher regulations to the supplement industry in the early 1990s, but the supplement industry used its lobbyists and those same consumers to write to their senators and congressional reps telling them to leave the supplement industry alone. Senator Orrin Hatch and Representative Bill Richardson killed the FDA's regulations and handed the supplement industry a big win. Fast forward to 2015, when the Attorney General of New York investigated multiple major retailers for selling many different supplements that did not contain anything except some ground-up vegetables. You truly have no idea what you're actually buying or swallowing when you take the majority of these supplements. Patrick Carroll, M.D. Regarding the sidebar in your article about supplements, CR tests turmeric and echinacea. When my bum knee starts to act up, I put more turmeric and freshly ground pepper on more of my food. Usually by the next day, the flare-up has subsided. In your article, when recalls fail, I have two devices you mentioned often left tested prior to implementation, leading to what you claim are issues that may develop post-surgery. There is no recommended solution other than for the reader to read between the lines and not undergo any of the procedures out of fear of device failure. My pacemaker has worked flawlessly, prevented me from passing out to a slow heart rate, and my hip replacement has gotten me off the opioids I needed to take prior to surgery for the constant extreme pain. Given the likelihood of significant monetary damages against any company that would intentionally foist inferior, untested products onto patients, it seems unlikely a company that produces these devices and surgeons who recommend them would market a product that would not function as advertised. The editor's note, that's by Andrea Harling. You're certainly not saying that consumers should never get medical devices implanted. They can be life-saving, But alas, cases of faulty and dangerous devices do exist, and in those instances, device manufacturers aren't always held accountable monetarily. Accordingly, we recommend that consumers ask their surgeons questions, such as what the device is made of, whether there are any adverse reports connected to it, why he/she recommended this particular device, and whether there are any other brands you would consider. Also ask your doctor to review with you a patient consent form, which entails what advice contains and what the risks are. Make sure you get a patient device card so that you're able to identify the model and serial number of your implantable device. That way, if there's a recall or a safety problem that develops with the device, you know exactly which product you have in your body. I like the wheel deal. I noticed that when you rate winter snow tires, you don't include studded tires. Why? I live in an area with a lot of rural roads. They're usually kept clear of snow, but ice is a problem. Winter snow tire models that could be studded to claw ice can be a smart choice if you live in a state with rough winters, though they can also be noisy and leave scratch marks in driveways. Otherwise, a top-rated studded winter snow tire should give you the added performance you need in winter weather. Still, winter crumbed ups with snow, some concessions, a potentially shorter tread wear, and some compromise of handling and grip on cleared roads. To see a video of our CR experts testing different types of tires breaking on ice, go to cr.org/ice0220. And we're almost time to close, so let's do some laugh lines. This is a breakfast joke. Dear cereal makers, exactly how tall do you think kitchen cabinet shelves are? A new study finds that sausages are often linked to other sausages. A frittata is just an omelet that studied abroad for a year in college. The quickest way to find out the time is to order beer at breakfast with your mother. If you're getting serious about someone, check what number their toaster is set on, because that's what you're going to live in with. My wife is going to make pancakes, and she wasn't. Then she was, then she wasn't, then she was. Now it looks like she's just waffling. And with that, we're approaching the time to end our talk for today. We've run out of time for today's episode of the Reader's Digest Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please don't hesitate to call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Actually, that's the NC Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so very, very much for listening.